Great, so welcome everyone. We did kind of informal introductions before, but my name is Alex Barabar. I'm a student at the Policy School and also at the Business School, a master's student, and the chair of the Diversity Talks seminar series. And we're really thrilled to have Cleo here with us today. She's going to give a talk about fatherhood and public policy. I'm just going to read a quick background about Cleo, so for everyone's education. Cleopatra Howard Caldwell is an associate professor of health behavior and health education at the School of Public Health, University of Michigan, where she's also the director of the Center for Research on Ethnicity, Culture, and Health. She's a faculty associate with the Program for Research on Black Americans at the Institute for Social Research and an affiliated faculty member in the Department of Psychology. Dr. Caldwell's research interest is in the area of psychosocial factors and family relationships as risk or protective factors for the well-being of ethnically diverse Black adolescents. Her community-based participatory research with non-resident African-American fathers and their pre-adolescent sons resulted in a promising youth risk behavior preventative intervention for African-American families. She's also collaborating with colleagues to examine the father's role in pregnancy outcomes as a way to expand discussions about reducing health disparities in birth outcomes. So, without any further delay, I think we'll hand it over. But we're really glad everyone's here and excited to hear from you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming out. Thank you so much for your patience. So I have a lot of information to present to you today, but as I said at the beginning, this is going to be an interactive presentation, so please feel free to stop me at any point that you have questions. I want to make sure you get a full understanding of what we're talking about, because from the policy end of things, this is the first time that we're presenting this information, and I'd like your feedback. Now, are most of you policy students or other kinds of backgrounds?
Some social work students.
Okay, and I see my friend back there who does have a policy background because he's actually worked on Capitol Hill. He's been responsible for a lot of initiatives in the drug abuse area, but still that strong policy background. And that's what I'm actually excited about being here today, because we've been doing research in an area dealing with non-resident African-American fathers and their pre-adolescent sons for a while from an intervention perspective. And we had an opportunity last year to stop, look at what we found, and begin to look at some of the policy influences that had already been done in terms of work where fatherhood had been examined. And that's what I want to talk about today, and that's what I'd like to get feedback on. The Flint Fathers and Sons Project was funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention back in probably 2003 is when we were funded to do the intervention work on it. We were initially funded probably in about 1999 as part of the Prevention Research Center that was established at the School of Public Health. So we are also a study that's a part of the Prevention Research Center. We're a study that's a part of CRESH. We're a study that's a part of everything. But we began at the very beginning, because we are a community-based participatory study, which means that we have community partners involved with what we were doing. We were interested in this whole idea of trying to develop an intervention that was going to have some kind of impact on preventing youth risk behaviors. African-American youth were identified as, it's another one of my colleagues coming in. Matter of fact, Ben was very significantly involved in the policy study that we're going to talk about, so I'm glad that he was able to make it today. We were very much interested in developing a preventive intervention for youth. At the time, we wanted to do something different than what others had already done, because there was so much emphasis on mentoring programs for youth, school-based programs for youth. We wanted to do something that was going to focus the youth as a part of his family, but providing an additional safety net for him. So what we wanted to do was to do work with the non-resident father, and I'll show you why in a second, that we work with the steering committee that's composed of several community-based organizations in Flint, Michigan, because this study was done in Flint. The original study was called the Flint Fathers and Sons Project, and that's very important because that's our home base. We're beginning to try to expand in other communities as we begin to try to replicate the study, but Flint is our home base. And that's where the study, we're trying to sustain the study there so that the community completely takes over implementing the project again. We also continue to meet. Over the last 10 years, the steering committee is still together. And we continue to meet, and we continue to think of ways of improving the study. We continue to think of ways of re-implementing the study. We've actually been funded again as part of the Youth Violence Prevention Center that's also been funded at CDC. And Mark Zimmerman is the director of that center. And they're doing a community-level violence prevention effort where there are 6 projects that are going on in a particular area of Flint, and Fathers and Sons is one of those 6 projects that's being replicated in a way there and expanded in many ways. And Cassandra Brooks, who's here with me today, is the project manager for Fathers and Sons. She's been the project manager from the beginning. So for the original study and now for the replication project where we're testing it in different ways. But it's a very important study because it's taking this kind of non-traditional approach, meaning a family-centered intervention that's dealing with the non-resident father. So I wanted to share just a little background with you about that project. But we were fortunate enough, as we were thinking about what does all of this mean, as we gather all of this data, as we learn more about what's happening in this intervention from a policy perspective, because there are different ways of thinking about meanings. You can think about the next intervention that you do, but you can also think about, from a larger scale, what might this mean? So we were fortunate enough to receive a grant from the Center for Public Policies and Diverse Societies from right here at the School of Public Health. And there, that allowed us a year to begin looking at the literature, looking at policies, and systematically trying to do some get an understanding of what had been done before and what policies existed out there that might have some relevance for what we were interested in. And we were able to produce some products from that particular study, one being this Fathers and Public Policies, Myths, Facts, Challenges, and Solutions. And one thing that we did develop was a complete report from that experience. And that's some of what I'm going to be sharing with you today, because that was a very interesting experience. We also had little pamphlets that we developed from that experience that allows us to share this information with the fathers who were participants in our project, but also to be distributed in the community, because our goal is to disseminate information that can be useful to our constituents. Yes? We're preparing them to put online. I say that because CRESH, the center that I'm the director of, that's what we're just redesigning our website, and we're doing that. And Cassandra's also designing the Fathers and Sons website, and I think the Youth Violence Prevention Center is also preparing them to put on their website. We're just trying to see the best format to get them in. But yes, we want to make them available. And actually, the school here has them as well because we submitted them as a part of the final report that we turned in here. But that's what we want to do. We want to make them available. Next. So in terms of background information, all of you know that from a public health perspective, substance use, violent behavior, and early sexual initiation, these continue to be problems. They were a part of Healthy People 2010. They continue to be public health problems as a part of Healthy People 2020. And these are areas that a lot of work has been done in. There have been promising interventions in these areas. Most of those interventions have focused on the youth themselves. Most of them have been school-based. I just returned recently from the American Public Health Association meetings that were held in Washington, D.C. 13,000 people. Always overwhelming meetings. But most of the intervention sessions that you go to are looking at youth within the context of schools. Most of them focus on youth peer relationships. Most of them focus on youth and trying to change the youth in some important ways. And some of them are having some effects. We know when we look at the correlates of what it's related to those kinds of behaviors that we're trying to influence, there are a number of things that are associated with that. And one of the things that we also know, there are many reports that are coming out now saying that focusing on just one area is probably not going to be as effective as focusing on multiple areas or levels of change. And therefore, you may want to consider doing more than just focusing on the youth. So focusing on different levels of change becomes important. And therefore, one of the things that we started doing was looking at those research interventions that focused on the family. So family-centered interventions become important. But when you look at family-centered interventions, what do you see? Who participates, do you think, in family-centered interventions? Ah, thank you. Yes, I like interactions. So mothers, that's right. You see mostly mothers and their children. That's when people say families in this country, most often they're talking about mothers and children. That's a good thing. That's a good thing. So most of our knowledge base is based around mothers and children. Most often, it's mothers and young children that we know. So a lot of information or a lot of interventions are done from that perspective. When we do that, we know that we can understand something then about the child who is embedded in families. So from a socio-ecological context, we know that the child is embedded within families, families are embedded within communities, communities are embedded within societies. Broffenbrenn, a long time ago, helped us to understand that all of these kinds of relationships are reciprocal. They influence each other. Public policies fit out here in society. So those policies that are implemented out there will have an impact on our lives. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and I've always had this interest in policy because it seems like it's so far away. What's happening in Washington, what's happening in Lansing, what's happening at local levels, whether it's the school board, what's happening in decision-making within our work environments, these are all policies. But they impact our lives, whether we know it or not. They impact our lives. So they're out there, and they have this influence upon us. But also what happens here impacts what policies get implemented in some ways. What's one big issue that you can think of with children that's having a huge impact from a policy perspective? When you say child, what's the next big education? Well, yeah, that's true.
Nutrition.
And stick with that nutrition needs. Childhood obesity. Thank you. Everything is related to childhood obesity. Everybody is trying to address this issue because we have never had a generation of kids that's expected not to outlive their parents before. So this has become a huge societal concern. And lots of resources, lots of areas, lots of disciplines are focusing their attention in this area. So you think about that, this has had a huge impact on what's happening here. It's typically the other way that you think it's going to go. So that's why this social context matters in many different ways. And from our perspective, we are putting the child within the context of the family in terms of the kind of work that we are doing. But we also know that family is influenced by the kind of neighborhoods that they live in, the kind of jobs that they have, the kind of schools that the children go to, and the kind of environment that they're in. So it doesn't stop with the family. We also know the community that our families live in. Our families live in Flint. The work that we've done so far, our families live in Flint. And the economic circumstance, long before the rest of the country was suffering, Flint had circumstances that they had to deal with. From our perspective, we also knew that there are 115 million men in the United States. 70 million or 61% are fathers.
Is that number, 115 million men, is that considered, is there an age for that?
Yes, in the childbearing range. So that's 18 to death. So and up, 18 and up from there, because that's the childbearing age. It's not considering the young ones. And about 9 million of them are African-American fathers. Among African-American fathers age 15 to 54, see there I had the space to put it in, 15 to 54, 41% are married and live with children, 22% are never married and live with their children. So you see that there are a lot of fathers out there. There are a lot of fathers who have contact with their children. And if we go on further, among African-American children age 18 and under, 67% did not live with their biological fathers in 2010. So that's a large percentage of African-American children who are not living with their biological fathers. That's not the percent who may be living with a social father, meaning a stepfather, grandfather of some type, but their biological fathers And there are projections that 80% at some point of African-American children are expected to spend a significant portion of their childhood not living with their biological fathers. So that's a large percentage. Large percentage of Latino children are also not as high as this. Yes. The 67% for African American. I didn't bring the chart that I have that shows from 1950 all the way through 2009 what the trends are, but the trends are moving up in terms of the proportion of kids. If you go all the way back when they first started doing this work in 1965 when Monahan did his report, when he was so horrified about the number of matriarchal families, back then it was 25%. And it's been trending upward since, yes. Two-parent families. Yeah, we do have two-parent families in black families. And then people transition in and out. It depends on what they mean. Because there are children who are in step-parent families that are stable families. You don't have to have a biological father to be a part of a stable family. Those are things that have to be clear. But part of the emphasis in terms of being able to say this is that we have many children who are living in single mother households. The other part of that story is just because you're in a single mother household doesn't mean you're destined to fail. There are a lot of things that go into success. One of the bases of having two adults present, because that's really what that translates into, it has economic issues. And it also has monitoring issues for adolescents. And that's critical because that contributes to the success of adolescents, especially in terms of risk behavior and academic success. So that's the biology is less important than what happens when you have two adults present in a household from an economic standpoint and from a socialization standpoint. So those things are critical. Because there are many African-American children who are raised successfully. But there are advantages of having gendered relationships as children are growing up. Because men and women do different things. Men and women do different things. So our work, as I mentioned before, is in the Flint community. And it's a community that may be different than other communities. So you want to pay attention to the type of community that you're working in. We have had very good relationships in the Flint community. The participant criteria in this study, African-American families, biological fathers, with their 8 to 12-year-old children, they lived in separate households. They had geographic requirement. The mother and guardian had to consent for the child to participate in the study. So we do have a bias in terms of mothers agreeing for the fathers to be in the study. I have to make that very clear. That is a bias in the study. And the father couldn't be impaired by substance abuse. And overall content area, just to give you a sense, we did focus groups in the beginning. There were a lot of procedures we went through to implement the theories that we had guiding the study. This presentation is not about that. But in general, the framework that we had for developing the curriculum for the intervention, because we had to do this from the very beginning, diversity among families was a very important theme that came out of that. We did focus groups with non-resident fathers, with non-resident sons, with mothers of non-resident sons, and also with two-parent families. Okay? Two-parent families with sons in, okay, with the same age group. Because we wanted to understand the issues from multiple perspectives, and these were the themes that came out. Personal relationships and responsibilities, these are all around fatherhood. Parent-child communications around values and expectations with these risk behaviors. Parenting skills. Fathers needed parenting skills. That's an important concept. And I have it phrased as sons' refusal skills, but it had to do with all of those influences on sons, including peer influences, about doing these things that we are trying to get them to avoid. And then, of course, social support, both informal social support, which brings in families and family members and the mothers of the child, as well as formal supports. And that supports from school systems, that supports from churches, service agencies. All of this came through in those focus groups that we did. Let's just move on. So the final intervention that we have has 15 sessions over a 2-month period. We had the sessions basically twice a week. And we had 45 hours involved, including intervention sessions, homework assignments, which these men were not happy about initially. And also community service events were a part of it. We had evaluation questionnaires and then a one-month booster session. Okay, I'm not going to dwell on the intervention itself. Just wanted to give you a flavor of what it's about. At the heart of what we were doing was involving them in a culturally based intervention. All of our products were geared toward their experiences as African-American men and boys. That was a very important part of what we did, and we focused on family activities. We had a quasi-experimental design, which means that we had an intervention group and we had a comparison group that did not receive anything. They just got the pretest and post-test questionnaires. We actually had 287 families in total. Overall response rate about 77%. These are with men. These are with men and non-resident fathers at that. Our goal was to have 150 in each group, but we ended up with 158 in intervention families with a response rate of 85%. They had a higher response rate than the comparison group. We had 129 there. The response rate was 69%. We missed some families when we should have gotten them in terms of their post-test questionnaires, but they didn't get anything in between. We did pay the families, and they did cooperate, but that, in the end, for some of them, that was not their motivation for participating. But overall attendance in those 15 sessions for the fathers, 77% of them attended 11 or more of those 15 sessions, and 78% of the sons attended 11 or more. So we had pretty good participation in this intervention. Real quickly, the two groups were pretty comparable. The only area in which the fathers differed was in terms of how long they lived with the son before they became non-residential. The comparison group lived with the sons a little bit longer than the intervention group. But in general, they were about 37 years old. They were 35% of them were married for the comparison group, compared to about 26% of them for the intervention group. And they were not married to the mothers of their son. Ever married to the mothers of their son, about 18% in the intervention group and about 21% in the comparison group. Most of them had a high school education or more, and most of them, it was about evenly split between their employment status. About half of them working, half of them not working, and therefore, as you would expect, most of them were in precarious kind of financial situations, split again, about half and half. Child support agreement, interestingly, two-thirds of them basically had a child support agreement with the child who was in the study with them. The sons, they were about 10 years old. In about fifth grade, the intervention group child had more siblings than the comparison group child. And about 60%, the 67% of them remembered living with their fathers. That's important because these kids are 8 to 12 years old. And so whether or not they lived with their child, their father was important. Most of them had lived up to age 5 or less as the average age of having lived with them. In general, from this study, lessons learned, diversity exists in the definition, structure, and functioning of non-resident African-American families. They're not all the same. We use that term non-resident, and we lump people together. Their experiences were very different. One of the activities we have in this intervention is called a family mission statement, and they then put together who their family is. And that's very important, especially for these children, because they are seeing their families in different ways, and their fathers are seeing these families in different ways. Whereas a father is a non-resident father to one child, he may be a resident father to another. That becomes extremely important, especially when you pay attention to some of these policies that exist out here and how they're structured. Non-resident African-American fathers can be effectively involved in their sons' lives. Parenting skills of non-resident African-American fathers can be enhanced. I'll show you that at the end as I put the policy recommendations and some of our findings together. Positive father involvement was associated with better outcomes for the fathers as well as the sons. And some of the fathers actually need mental health assistance in order to fulfill their family responsibilities. So, in a nutshell, that's what the background is for the basis of the next study. And this study, we were interested in reviewing public policies that were intended to assist fathers with their fathering responsibilities beyond the provider role. That was our lofty hope as we started this whole process, because we know that there are a number of policies that are in place to help fathers with establishing paternity, to help fathers with custody kinds of issues, to help father with employment, because economic stability is a huge focus because of that provider role that the father plays in the family. If you look at the family literature, so much of it focuses on the father as the provider for the family. And that's exactly how the policy follows, trying to stabilize the father as the economic provider in the family. So we were trying to see, is there policy, are there policies out there that also helps in the fathering role that has to do with the emotional socialization of the child, with the developmental aspects of that relationship, with those qualities of fathering that are also important for the development of the child. So we wanted to identify policies that address diverse groups of resident and non-resident fathers, because that's another thing that we realized, that some policies really are addressing resident fathers. They're not speaking to non-resident fathers, and that's a huge divide. We wanted to consider the definition of fatherhood. And so we realized we needed to go back to try to understand, what does fatherhood mean? We had to do that in our initial study in terms of trying to define, what did non-resident mean? A lot of times when I begin to do this presentation in other kinds of environments, when I'm focusing just on the other part of the study, somebody will raise their hand and say, oh, so you're talking about absent fathers. No, I'm not. These fathers are available to their children. Very different concepts, so you really have to understand what are you talking about. We wanted to assess prominent presidential initiatives, because some presidents have actually taken this on. So we wanted to try to be aware of what was happening, and then we wanted to highlight a few exemplary state and local policies, because some people are getting it right in terms of doing those things that they say that they're going to do. It's interesting how there are inconsistencies in what legislation says it's going to do and how it then gets implemented. And then we wanted to recognize continuing challenges to father involvement. This is an elusive concept. This is an elusive concept, especially when you're trying to implement it through policy. So that was kind of a fascinating finding. And then we wanted to suggest some directions, at least based on some of the findings that we have. So we started with this whole thing of defining dads, so definitions of fatherhood throughout history. So if we go there, we went back to 18th century, so colonial America and the English common law. How many people are familiar with English common law? All right. So we came over here. Now, we were doing some research recently on this idea of masculinity and the meaning of masculinity and hegemonic masculinity and how that came over from Europe as well, and the need for men to dominate women as a part of their masculine identity. And sometimes I say, wonder why we brought these things from Europe. But conceived the father, so the English common law conceived the fatherhood in terms of economics, purely economics. No confusion here. Very clear. Husbands were perceived as owners of their wives. Fathers were perceived as owners of their children. No confusion whatsoever. Husbands and fathers were owners of their wives and children's labors. They were in charge of the family. They controlled the economic situation. They controlled who the wives were. They controlled who the children were. But with that level of control also came the responsibility of having to provide for them, that they were solely responsible for supporting them, and they also provided the status of the family. So who that family was. There's a carryover with that today, actually, because this status thing for some people really, really matter. You may know some people. It's very important to them to be Mrs. blah, 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 because that Mrs. blah, blah, blah brings a lot of status to them. That's changed a lot over generations. But for some people, that really still matters to be Mrs. blah, blah, blah. So when I'm dealing with older people, I make sure I understand how they want to be addressed, because they will correct you if it's important to them to be Mrs. blah, blah, blah. But that's a carryover from the English common law. Go to the next one. Because a part of that had a marital presumption. And that marital presumption assumed that if a child was born within a marital union, that child belonged to the father. That child belonged to the father. No questions were asked. And this law was created to protect children from this concept of illegitimacy and to protect the sanctity of marriage. You're married. So it has to be the father's child, right? Mother's baby, father's maybe? Those questions weren't asked. Okay? In practice, it reinforced marriage as a social norm, and it punished women who did not conform. So if they found out that was not your husband's child, then there were sanctions. And there's an interesting case study in New Haven that was done. We're going to have several little clips here that demonstrated this, that it was an uneven application of this law. Oh, can't see this at all, can we? Wow. So what it says is punishment for fornication. There were fines and corporal punishment instituted if it was found out that your child did not belong to your husband. But the way that this was carried out, and this study was done back in the, I think it was 1730, that fathers were rarely identified under these. Thank you. Brought it to life. I was going to have to rely on my memory or ask Ben. Fathers rarely were identified in these kind of situations because they were brought to court. These were legal issues. These are legal definitions of fatherhood. And in 1930s, it was unequal prosecution. Only 25% of the 190 cases that this study looked at involved a man being held accountable for the child, meaning financially responsible for that child if he was born out of wedlock or wasn't the father's child. In the 190 cases that were involved, the woman was always held responsible under these circumstances. So there was a terrible, uneven distribution. It wasn't until the 1970s, think about that, all the way from colonial time until the 1970s, that's my lifetime. That's my almost adult lifetime that it took before major challenges to the marital assumption occurred. And it happened because of large social changes in society and political changes that were happening within society. And this came under the ambiguous fatherhood was the concept that was being used. What was happening around that time? You're too young to remember. Y'all probably weren't even born then. But anti-war protests going on, a lot of protests, civil rights, lots of freedoms. But during that time, as we were going through all of those kinds of freedoms, a lot of increase in non-marital births. So from a societal perspective, the social norm around birth was changing. At one time, if you were pregnant and you weren't married, you were shipped off somewhere. Either you got married right away, shotgun weddings, you ever heard of that? Or you were shipped off and hidden until the baby was born. All kinds of things happened so that it was not made public that you were pregnant and not married. But this issue of non-marital birth came to light in the 70s. Which then began to challenge this idea of the marital presumption, that if you're married, that it had to be your husband's child. And that then came with other kinds of definitions of fatherhood. Social fathers were not the biological fathers, because social fathers could be married or not married to the mother of the child. And if there's no adoption involved, then who's the father? That became legal issues. What people do informally is different than when a court has to get involved. And these are important legal issues because what happens to the child in terms of inheritance? What happens to the child in terms of birthright? These are legal issues in terms of fatherhood. Or if there's no social father, if the biological father is not married to the mother, if paternity hasn't been established, what does that mean? We see these played out all the time, especially when there are large estates involved. So these become really important issues to understand. So Supreme Court cases came about to decide it for us. So it was in 1972, Stanley versus Illinois, when unmarried fathers were given some parental rights. 1972, that just keeps blowing my mind. Because again, these are years that I'm alive and I'm functioning out here in the real world, not aware of any of this. Unmarried fathers could be legally defined as a father. 1972. I'm around a whole lot of men who thought they were fathers but didn't know that they weren't legally fathers. But it had to depend on their relationship with their children. It wasn't as easy as it sounded. In 1978, Quinlan Wilcott and also another case, I don't know how it's pronounced, but Caban and Muhammad, it reinforced that the relationship between an unmarried father and his children was important in terms of establishing paternity. So more and more now, people are beginning to establish paternity. And then in 1989, this was an upheaval here, because in this particular case, Michael H. versus Gerald D., so you can see these are two people who are saying, I'm the father, the court found in favor of the marital presumption. So what worked there? They denied the biological father legal fatherhood to protect the marital family union. So you go back to that idea about the relationship of the child. The court's job is always to protect the child. And under some circumstances, they will make a decision that's not in favor of the biological father. So we have to pay attention to the color we use in slides in the future. But the relationship is a part of that. So it's a complex definition for fatherhoods when you start thinking about it from a legal perspective. It's a complex definition. You have to consider if the father is unmarried, whether or not paternity has been established, whether or not there is a maternal marriage involved, whether or not there is a relationship between the child and the father, and whether or not what the social context is. Because low-income fathers may experience one thing, upper-income fathers may experience something else. So when we say fatherhood, it's not an easy term. When we say unmarried fathers, it's not easy. When we say non-resident fathers, it's not easy from a policy perspective. Okay? So along with all of that complication, then we have all kinds of legal issues that are going on that have implications for fatherhood. In the 1970s, we start with this whole movement to remove this term illegitimacy from our legal system. Because at one time, in legislation, children were referred to as illegal, they were referred to as bastards, they were referred to with all of this derogatory language. It took all the way until 1970s for this language to really become banned from our laws. And that was really important to do. In 1974, through Title 4D of the Social Security Act, it actually created the Child Support Enforcement Act. And the whole basis of this act really was the establishment of paternity. What's an important part of that whole establishment of paternity? Once the state can require that you establish paternity, what can it then do? Yes. Very important, absolutely. Once we know you're declared the father, then you're responsible for supporting your child. And that's what we mean by fatherhood. We want you to declare responsibility for this child, because then the state no longer has to support this child. So Congress passed the child enforcement amendments to strengthen these kind of child support laws in terms of making it easier for you to declare that kind of responsibilities. And the Family Support Act came along. This was in 1988. We're still tweaking it. These are all the kinds of emphasis that they're putting on fathers. So fatherhood is still being defined economically. Still being defined economically. So the state is stepping back in terms of, we now know who fathers are when we are talking about unmarried people and having births that are occurring outside of marriage. So this whole issue of ambiguous fatherhood now, from a policy perspective, is becoming clearer. And we can step away from being responsible for these children and now have fathers involved. So we are talking about fathers being mentioned in legislation way back in 1936 in the Social Security language. Fathers were mentioned a long time ago. Then we move up to the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Act. It's talking even more strongly about the importance of fathers and the nurturing role that fathers should play in their children's lives, and how fathers also have a responsibility to mothers, using very good language, but its emphasis is in another direction. And this becomes extremely important because we had something else happening at the same time, a lot of research funding going into science policy. And a big benefit of that science policy was research funding for the Human Genome Project. And there were a lot of discoveries that made paternity testing affordable, but more importantly, reliable. So now establishing paternity became much easier, much easier. So states were willing to pay for it. And they were willing to pay so that 90% of the people now coming through requesting support from the state had to comply with mandatory testing and establishing paternity. And they couldn't say, I'm not the father, because they could say, aha, here's DNA. We got you. And you are responsible. So genetic testing technologies took paternity testing to another level. So the shift in financial responsibility for children born out of wedlock went from states to biological fathers. Okay? So again, that economic responsibility laid on fathers, and the definition of fathers to this day is now based on biology. Now based on biology. So that becomes extremely important. So federal fatherhood policies today, we know they're based on that biology, but there are a lot of programs out there. I was impressed when we started this work. There are a number of agencies under the current administration that said that they have fatherhood policies, programs, initiatives directed directly at fathers. And there are an interrelated group of federal agencies, Department of Agriculture, Department of Commerce, the cooperation of the National and Community Services, Department of Education, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, Department of Health and Human Services, Department of Housing and Urban Development, Department of Justice, Department of Labor, Office of National Drug Control Policy, Department of Veteran Affairs. When I first looked at this, I like this because it said Department of Agriculture, under which WIC falls, so that's women, infants, and children. They say fathers can come in and get food for their children if they needed it, and all the way through Veterans Affairs. That's a national cemetery. So that really is covering birth to death when you look at it. But now what you have to stop and do is to see the types of programs that they do offer. And it varies in terms of what they do. They have some very interesting programs, because some of them have things like programs to support fathers supporting mothers and breastfeeding, for example. Very nice program. Except the funding is running out. They do have a few pamphlets available. But Early Head Start was one of their big efforts in terms of engaging fathers. Early Head Start was one of their big efforts. And I'm going to go through these really quickly. One of the issues there in terms of evaluating the program, that has a mandate for people to involve, programs to involve fathers. Their efforts, however, seem to be towards resident fathers as opposed to non-resident fathers. Some programs did have non-resident fathers, but in terms of their efforts, more efforts were made towards more resident fathers were participating. They didn't make a big effort towards any of them, I should say that. But more resident fathers participated than non-resident fathers. The huge program that speaks to addressing fathers is the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF. TANF is the old, for those of, yeah, still too young, AFDC program. Lots of changes happened there, changed the name, it became TANF. And this is the Temporary Assistance for Needy Programs, and this is a huge welfare program. Came as a result of welfare reform, and this is where a lot of the fatherhood programs fall. But at the heart of TANF is the idea of marriage and two couple families. And that's what they require in a lot of their program. So these healthy marriage initiatives and responsible fatherhood initiatives come under this program. We keep moving forward. And that's when we can go back and look across several prominent presidential administrations and some of their initiatives that address fathers. Go back to Johnson administration, because he was very much concerned about the war on poverty. And economic opportunities for men was a part of that, speaking to the need for men to support their families again. But what was interesting about this, the Job Corps, and that was a big deal back in the 60s, the Job Corps. But what was really interesting about that, the Job Corps required young men to move away from their families in order to be trained. So it wasn't strengthening families from that perspective, because they had to leave home to do it. The Clinton administration was the big one on welfare reform. And this is when TANF changed from AFDC to TANF in its current form. So that was a huge undertaking. What was more supportive was the Family and Medical Leave Act that came out of his administration that now allows fathers to participate in things like maternity leave just like mothers. What's still interesting about this legislation, that's 12 weeks of unpaid leave. So it's not like you get paid. So lots of advocates now saying this isn't going to do people who work certain types of job any good because they can't afford to take off if they're not paid. So there are all kinds of issues with that, but the idea was at least good to include fathers. And of course, we have these initial fatherhood initiatives. So this language of responsible fatherhood initiative first came way back then, except that all of the money went for economic stability. So it was still focused on those fatherhood economic issues or father as provider role. George W. Bush's administration, the Marriage Act, just characterized his as that. Because under the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005, he again had the Healthy Marriage Initiatives and Responsible Fatherhood Program. Same language around strengthening families and the importance of fathers, but everything, all monies, all directives was towards getting people married. Marriage is important. Families will be healthy, children will be healthier if the mother and father are married. And then the Obama administration, Responsible Fatherhood and Healthy Marriage Initiatives, just had a round of funding under these initiatives again. Very interesting what the requirements were. They mentioned parenting a lot better than some of the previous administrations, but the emphasis in the applications, when you apply for those applications, focused on issues like domestic violence, focused on issues, again, around economic stability, focused on big part on healthy marriage initiative, very little on parenting. So it's interesting what people want. And part of it has to do with this definition of father involvement. We know in the past, so much of father involvement meant payment. We need child support. Current directions recognize that it has multiple characteristics of fathers that need to be involved. So as we talk about policies, we have to get these definitions under control a little better. Originally, Michael Lamb had three aspects of fathering: parent engagement, parent availability, and parenting responsibility. So support is a part of it, but it's a small part, not a small part of it. It's an important part of it, but there are other aspects to fathering involvement that we have to pay attention to. Contact with the child, accessibility in interacting with them, and time spent in the decision-making around child-rearing tasks. So all of that's involved with fathering. And an example of an innovative state policy is one that's called Parenting Time Credit. This is a case in Indiana. Child support payments can be reduced or reversed with custodial parents who makes more money when the non-custodial parent spends significant time and contributes to the growth and development of his children. And the court actually defines what significant time means. Significant time means that father spends time helping the child with the homework, spends time helping the child participate in extracurricular activities, spends time going to the school with the child, spends time doing those things that contributes to that child's growth and development. So not just, oh, I stopped by and I saw my child and I left, but spend those quality times and those socialization tasks that's going to make a difference in that child's life.
Did you come across any information if the mother was opposed to the father spending more time?
No, these have to be situations where they agree to this. Yeah, that they work it out. They're co-parenting. And these are things that both parents say will be good for the child. So those are the kinds of things that they're working in for the good of the child. But this is the level of flexibility that the court is willing to do and not just say, give me your money, because the circumstance now is that the father has to pay X number of dollars. And the formula that they do has not, in some states, have nothing to do with how much the father earns. These are problems. These are problems. That's why this is an example of a very innovative approach to this. Other considerations, alternative definitions for father involvements are needed. For example, the percentage of allowed visit time actually spent with children. Nobody actually checks that. When the father's told he has so much time that he can spend with his child, nobody ever checks to see. Does he even spend any time with his child? There are so many punitive laws that are set up for fathers that assumes that he's not doing what he's supposed to do. And that's an assumption that needs to be challenged by actually tracking what do fathers do. Child support compliance ratios. How many fathers actually comply with these expectations? Everything is set up as if the father is not going to comply. So better definitions that involve emotionally supportive behaviors, cognitively stimulating behaviors, instrumental is where child support comes in, involvement, and feelings of competence regarding their parental contributions. So many fathers, when you talk to them, really feel like, I'm just a money machine. Nobody cares that I care about my child. And that's something that really needs to change. The whole idea of sharing and caring, providing guidance, providing support, serving in culturally specific roles, these are important roles for fathers within the family. So past policy directions, a lot of the assumptions were based on divorced fathers, and sometimes there can be those bitter relationships. White fathers, mothers reported data. That's the other thing. So much of this work is reported by the mothers. So policies are based on research studies where mothers have provided the information rather than studies that have actually involved fathers. Fathers of young children, that's the other thing. It doesn't give you a life course perspective in terms of fathers' involvement with their children at different developmental stages. And then signal partner fertility fathers. The assumption is that fathers have only fathered children with one woman. Okay? So another innovative state policy, earned income tax credit, New York and D.C., non-custodial parents who pay child support in full during the tax year can receive tax credit regardless of whether or not they may have missed a monthly payment during the year as long as they have caught up on their child support payment by the end of the tax year. So sometimes you may have missed a payment, but as long as you're up to date by the end of the year, you can still claim tax credits. Now, there are some areas that only allows one person to claim the tax credit, and that's a problem overall. So new directions need to be based on father-reported data, considering unmarried parents, not just considering the idea of parents must be married. New definitions of involvement needs to be multidimensional, and diversity among families. What's happening in different ethnic groups needs to be considered. What happens by age of father needs to be considered. What happens with low-income groups needs to be considered. So we had a number of findings in the Fathers and Sons intervention that suggested monitoring behavior of fathers can improve, communication about sex, race-related socialization, parenting skill satisfaction, intentions to communicate. Intervention fathers requested assistance for drinking problems more often, and depressed fathers cannot effectively parent. We also found that sons also felt their fathers were monitoring them more and that they could talk to their fathers more about sex and they intended to avoid violent behavior. From a family perspective, when we improve fathers' parenting attitudes related to increased attention to avoid violence, sons' intention to avoid violence increase, and when we increase fathers' parenting behaviors, sons' aggressive behaviors were reduced. And better parenting was associated with less depressive symptoms among fathers, and diversity among non-resident fathers' sons was important. So from a recommendation, and I only have a couple here, so we'll be finished soon, we're saying that this definition of non-resident father must be defined. It must be defined as a multidimensional concept that represents the diversity of fathering experience that exists among African-American men. Our data showed these can be non-resident fathers to some children, but resident to others. Multi-partner fertility. All fathers are not having children with just one woman. So when you write a policy that says they must do something with one woman, that becomes a problem. They are linked to multi-fertility households, meaning they can have children in more than one household and non-resident, but they have custodial rights. That's a different kind of father. So those are very different kinds of non-resident fathers. So what is the relevance of TANF's formation of healthy marriages and two-parent families priority criteria for these fathers with pre-adolescent sons? We had about 17% of the fathers in our study who were already married. So what does that TANF law mean for them when they're already married to somebody else? Parental monitoring and academic success are two of the best predictors for preventing youth risky behavior, and the intervention program improved fathers' ability to monitor their son's behavior, even though they did not live together. So monitoring son's homework and after-school activities are critical father involvement tasks. Yet non-resident fathers don't receive their son's report cards or any school's reports firsthand. So we recommend the Department of Education's Blueprint for Reform for Elementary and Secondary Education Act should address this issue as part of their father engagement effort. They actually say they have a father engagement effort. Where they have it is in their adult literacy programs. And what they're suggesting is we want to improve father's literacy so he can help his child with his homework. That's good. But they can actually take it a step farther and have schools work with fathers to engage fathers. Because when schools think about parent engagement, they're thinking about mothers. So how much more effort would it take to also send those report cards home to non-resident fathers? You can also work at the local level with schools to try to change policies in support of having more involvement of non-resident fathers. Mothers and fathers have to work together. Co-parenting is a critical concept in all of this. We also found fathers who improved their parenting behaviors reported fewer depressive symptoms at the end of the intervention. However, 47% of fathers had moderate to severe depressive symptoms at baseline, and those with severe symptoms were less likely to monitor, be supportive, or be close to their sons. So these findings highlight the need for mental health services for non-resident fathers. So we recommend that TANF funds are increased to support fatherhood initiatives that include mental health services related to family functioning and multiple non-resident family members to ensure improved functioning. You can't do what you need to do around parenting if you have the potential of having severe mental health problems. Catching people at the symptomatology level can be very useful. So although three presidential administrations have implemented various forms of responsible fatherhood initiatives, none of these bills have required strong parenting skills component as part of these fatherhood programs. So the current administration comes closest to at least using the right language. So they have stronger emphasis on parenting skills training for fathers, especially for diverse groups, could be beneficial for both the fathers and children. We've actually done some work where they benefit from this. And we're trying to get some funding where we can actually test it in a larger context. So expanding current father-friendly legislation to be more focused on parent training would be a step in the right direction for enhancing family health. Because this is not about the child when you go back to the socio-ecological model. It's about the family. Because you start strengthening families. Should be the last slide. You start strengthening families, then you're working towards enhancing communities and enhancing society overall. And there are policies that are already out there that could be strengthened or implement what they say, because some of them actually have the right language. They just don't go the step farther. They always fall back on the economic side of fathering because probably that's easier to implement and to test and to evaluate than some of these other areas. So I'll stop there. So thank you for your attention. I know our time is out, but if you have one or two.
For one or two questions.
Is there any plans for a follow-up study on fathers and their daughters?
We always get that question. That is something that we have. We have plans for replicating this in other communities. Right now, we are in the process of preparing a proposal for the Chicago area, the Woodlawn community of Chicago. That's, again, with fathers and sons. We also have plans to try to replicate it with different ethnic groups. Latino families would be the next group we would do. And we also have plans to involve mothers more because of the importance of co-parenting. So fathers and daughters become another important group that we're interested in working with. We have to go back to the drawing board theoretically in terms of understanding what's best for that group. Right now, we have expanded what we're doing in Flint to include not only non-resident fathers, but also the social fathers. And we're also including an older age group of kids. So we're trying to do it in different forms because we think there are some basics underlying aspects of the intervention that will translate well. But then we think there are new components that have to be added when we start adding different groups. So that's the long way of saying yes. Yes.
In circumstances where the non-resident father has a second family, did you look at all about how the second family feels about the father getting more involved with the original family?
We did not contact the family that he lives with at all. We have an activity within the context of the intervention called the Family Mission Statement, and we have both the father and the son work through that because it's how they see that family. Because some of the families see them as blended families. Some of them see them as separate families. So it's a part of how they visualize and see and work through what that means. So that's why I say diversity among families is an extremely important issue. And I think that's a critical factor because some kids will see themselves as having two families that are really very united. Others will see very divided. One of the things that we had to make a decision in order to try to maintain family harmony, most often in a research study, you would bring in one parent and one child to keep it clean, unless you're going to have a large enough sample to have multiple kids in order to do something like an HLM. In this case, we told fathers they could bring in any son who was non-resident who fit our age range, because we have a wide age range, 8 to 12 from a developmental perspective, because we were already causing problems by not bringing in the daughter. We were also causing problems by not bringing in the resident son who fits study criteria. So those are all things that when we think about families and you're intervening in families, you're messing in people's lives, because that father had to deal with that child he lived with and doing something special with the child he didn't live with. So he had to actually manage those kinds of family issues, but it was important enough for him to really try to build that relationship with that non-resident child. Because he lived with the resident child, it was easier probably to deal with him about it because he was with him more. But good question.
Some of your measures, if you were measuring, you know, whether some of the sons express less aggressive behavior, things like that, then to me it makes sense that you are matching the fathers with the son, right? Because it seems like the end goal is that you want these sons to grow up to then be active fathers in their own families. And it almost seems like there's like a, you want to break the cycle kind of thing.
Right. What do you mean matching fathers with sons?
The fact that you're not working with fathers and daughters, but that you're doing the study with fathers and sons.
Yeah, the study is fathers and sons.
Right. So then,
and they have to come to the intervention together.
Right. But so I'm speaking to the point about, you know, whether or not you want to do fathers and daughters or something like that. But to me it makes sense that because of what you're measuring, you know, like you're trying to see, okay, are the sons exhibiting less aggressive behavior? Which maybe means that you're making some statement about, you know, boys who grow up without fathers maybe are more aggressive and then are harder, they have a more difficult time socializing, and then, you know, effects happen after that.
Okay, but you've lost me with what your question is?
No, I didn't actually have a question. I was just making a comment about these two questions that were just asked.
About whether or not we are working with daughters?
Yes. Yeah. That's it. I was making a comment.
Okay, let me make a comment. Now, let me make a comment. When you're doing research, one of the things that you have to do is be very clear about which variables you have and which you don't have. When you start bringing daughters in, that's another population that you have to account for. When you bring another ethnic group in, that's another variable you have to account for, which means that you have to account for the sample size and the power that you need in order to be able to test any kind of effects. So the more you bring in, that means the more money you need in order to be able to get the sample size that you need in order to be able to show any effects at all. So what we are doing when we're limited to males, when we're limited to African Americans, is we're controlling on those variables so that we can see. We also limited to biological. So that's another thing, because we know in African American families, social fathers are also extremely important. So that's another group that we could have said, just bring any father in here. But then we wouldn't have a better understanding, a good understanding as we have now about the relationships that we are describing. So we set parameters around the study. So we could have said, we'll take any child, and then we could get the study done much faster. But we set very clean parameters around what we were doing so that we could have a better understanding of what we were doing. Does that make sense? Okay. Yes, we are trying to create an additional safety net for the child that he would not ordinarily have by not having a stronger bond with the father, because we're trying to strengthen those bonds. And we also are asking questions about the father's relationship with his father, because, again, this is an intergenerational kind of look at what's happening. The proposal that we're putting it again to NIH now is describing it as intergenerational health among men, because we have the sons and we have the fathers, and we ask about previous generations. So we are trying to do that. And the fathers do share their experiences when they were young, and they are trying to break cycles around teenage pregnancy, around gang violence, around all of that. And that's important for them to be able to talk about these issues and transmit the values that they want their sons and expectations that they have so that they know that. When they're confronted with peer influences, when they're confronted with media, when they're confronted with all of these other things, when they have to make decisions, that we think that that becomes extremely important. When they hear females' perspectives on this, that's one perspective. But this gives them another perspective that helps them when they have to make those kinds of decisions. And what we're finding is that male voice is very important for these boys, especially boys who are raised in a society where they are recognized as African American males. Yes.
Do you find when you do have drop-offs, say, in the middle of the session, or if you're on the opposite side, having people come in and try to, you know, bring things back together with their sons following a period of maybe having some rockiness or not seeing them as much, that the lack of presence of a child is often a factor? Because something I've been interested in looking at is whether the degree of a father's involvement, you know, varies over time.
We almost had 50-50 split in terms of fathers who were employed and fathers who were unemployed. So that's why we were surprised when they said 70% of them had child support agreements. But the question we didn't ask, how up to date are you in your child support agreement? So that's something that we need to ask this time around, because I think that's really a very good point. We know the literature says, with regard to fathers' involvement, that a lot of fathers are not involved when they don't have the financial resources that they can contribute. Part of what we were doing in this intervention is we were saying, regardless of whether or not you can contribute, you still have a responsibility to your child, and you need to work through what you can contribute, even though you may not be able to contribute at the level that you, the court says you should contribute, that there are other things that you can do that are going to benefit your child. That's why that Indiana law was so unique. And being able to do things that are still going to benefit your child. If you're the one who can sit down and help him with his homework, That's a huge contribution. Even though you still need to put food on the table and you need a roof over your head, your being absent is not doing that child any good whatsoever because you're still not giving him any money. But those things that you can contribute, the thing that we also found for fathers who really felt pride in the fact, parenting satisfaction, that motivated them a lot more. So my thing is, if you got $50, you can give your kid $25. So those are the kind of responsibilities. Taking on the responsibilities is what's more important than the court telling you, well, you must give your child $65. The court's not going to change. They're going to continue to do that. But even if you can't give your child that, if you give them what you can, that's a step in the right direction. So that's part of where we're trying to go to help those who are willing. There's some people, it doesn't matter, they can make $1 million and they still don't support their child. When I was on Capitol Hill, that's why we have some of these tough child support laws, because it was some of the most wealthiest fathers who would not support their kids.
In regards to her question, the other thing is that oftentimes, I personally cannot remember any fathers that didn't come because they weren't employed, but there were oftentimes fathers couldn't come because they got a job. And when they were in the study, and there were also a couple of fathers that told us to make their checks payable to their sons.
Right, the incentive, the financial incentive that they got for the program, they turned it over to their sons. Right. We had one father who had an attendance problem because he had a health issue, and we had a requirement in the study that you had to come together because most of the activities the fathers and sons had to do together. But one of the things that was happening in this intervention, and that's something that we're trying to build on as we try to move towards sustainability in the Flint community, the other fathers had bonded. So they were willing to take responsibility for that child while his father was in the hospital. So they wanted the son to continue to come, even though the father couldn't come because he was in the hospital. Under those circumstances, we said, okay, what were we going to do? But I thought that was really a sense of good bonding, that fathers also need that support. So that's why we're saying in these parenting skills program, it's more than just the money. It's that kind of bonding, support, and reinforcement that I can be a good father that's going to turn a lot of this around rather than make sure you have made all of your child support payments. Okay.
Well, thanks so much for the great talk, and thanks to everyone for coming. There's a sign-in sheet if you haven't signed already, just for kind of our own data keeping purposes. And yeah, thanks again.
Thank you.